You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
On the Breakfast Grill today is Nadarev Yebmadia Sanyo, Executive Director of Greenpeace for Southeast Asia. Greenpeace is an international NGO which wants to solve environmental problems by using non-violent, creative confrontation to expose global environmental problems. That's according to the website. Today we're going to explore how to balance economic growth with pressing environmental problems. If you have any comments, tweet us or WhatsApp us. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Julian. Good morning to your listeners at BFM.
Now tell us, what are Greenpeace's plans in Southeast Asia?
Yes, Greenpeace is celebrating more than 40 years globally, and in Southeast Asia, we've been here for 16 years. Our plans really is to pursue that vision of a green and peaceful Southeast Asia, vibrant with an economy that is sustainable. That is our vision for Southeast Asia, and we know that this is an important region in terms of global economy. We have at least 630 million people in Southeast Asia. What we care about, how all of the people will be able to live in harmony with nature and afford us that that future where we all live with resources that can support us and avoid the future where we grapple with huge, serious challenges on the environment.
And you've given a backdrop that's also coupled with that desire for economic growth. And I want to ask you, how big are Southeast Asia's environmental problem compared with the rest of the world, especially developed markets, given that it warrants a dedicated Southeast Asian office of which you're the executive director?
So Southeast Asia is definitely a key planetary battleground. We talk about huge planetary issues like climate change and the continued dependence of the world on fossil fuels, for example. And then we have vast disappearing forests in Southeast Asia. These are the more important issues that we face for the region. And Greenpeace has in every interest to ensure that these resources, whether it's forest, land, air, water, we want to protect all of this, and we know that in the context of the conversation on the bigger issues like climate change, Southeast Asia is the source of a lot of greenhouse gas emissions with our huge deforestation rate and our continued reliance on coal and oil.
So there is a conundrum there because Southeast Asia, together with the rest of the emerging markets, are in a different economic growth phase from the developed markets. Do you think developing economies should be given some dispensation to, so to speak, harm the environment as the developed markets had done so a long time ago?
I think dispensation is not the right word that to use for framing the context of emerging economies. I think, and we believe there is a lot of evidence to show that it will be more costly for our societies if we don't take care of the environment, and that's what we want to foster. There is it's not an illusion that we can grow our economies by taking care of the environment. I think there's already a lot of evidence out there that show that if we develop the economy sustainably in a clean way, it will even be better for us in the long run. So,
what are some of these concrete plans that can be implemented? For example, if you look at the population growth, as you mentioned, it's so great, and there would be greater need for example, housing, economic activity, which is environmentally harming, to create jobs. So the question is, what are some of these concrete plans that can be implemented?
Yes, there are different aspects to sustainable growth. And also when we talk about long-term development, we want to ensure that we have these resources at our disposal. But you see, there's this misperception that we can harness resources infinitely, but that's not the case. Everything around us comes from nature, whether it's raw material or even the air we breathe, the food that we produce. everything has a price, and that should be integrated into how we relate to the environment. We're talking about, and the biggest one for Southeast Asia and for most emerging developing economies is the use of energy. And right now, the bulk of the energy we use come from burning from fossil fuels, and that's not sustainable given the big problem of climate change and how it is turning into a crisis. What we need to do is shift to alternative means of
generating. But that's expensive, right? The renewables have not become cheaper than traditional ways of generating electricity. So should there be some alternative form of funding as well from, for example, more developed nations and richer nations into developed economies so that they can have a viable renewables agenda?
Absolutely. But I'd like to tackle the issue of price, and when we say it's not cheap, when we say it's expensive, we need to look at the timetable. It might seem expensive upfront, but for the long term, it will be better for us financially. And
who pays for it in the short term, though? And in that gestation period of 10, 20 years, who pays for it?
Yeah, there are a lot of mechanisms now that allow us to tackle that price concern, and whether it's leveling the playing field for the market for developers of renewable energy, for example, you have mechanism, for example, ensuring that they get their profits by spreading the cost across entire markets, and that can be in a form of feed-in tariffs for renewables that's already being implemented in certain Southeast Asian countries.
Which is funded. Feed-in tariffs, for example, in Malaysia is funded by the Malaysian government. And I'm not sure how the health of the Malaysian government coffers are looking right now with oil prices being quite volatile. And Malaysia has other economic challenges. But I think this is representative of the financial status of many emerging markets. Feed-in tariffs are something that still has to be subsidized from government coffers.
Well, in some cases, it will have to be subsidized in a way because you're leveling the playing field. But I wanted to introduce the issue of climate justice. You mentioned it earlier, how we can access resources from richer nations so that we get to leapfrog and avoid the mistakes they made as far as damaging the environment is concerned. And I think that can be done. We know that climate change, for instance, is a problem hugely caused by the industrialization of the West, or what some would call the North. And we want to have that conversation and, in fact, be able to set up those clear, concrete mechanisms so that financing or funding can go to developing countries so that we do leapfrog in terms of technology and solutions.
On the Breakfast Grill today is Nadarev Yepsanyo, Executive Director of Greenpeace Southeast Asia. And Yep, talking about the West, recently we had the election of Donald Trump, which many people didn't expect. And one of key Donald Trump's key policies would be to make the United States grow again. For example, he greenlighted the Keystone Oil Project. One would think that this would lead to more environmental degradation. Now, so we're talking about this tug of war that's going on here between the policies of Donald Trump, which are capitalistic in nature, and a kind of social democracy advocated by the other presidential candidates who unfortunately didn't win. If capitalism in the past hasn't effectively addressed global environmental problems, can other political systems do that, address environmental problems?
Well, we might be going ahead of ourselves if we suddenly think that there's a silver bullet to everything and changing the political system. That might be a long-term solution, but right now we are in flux, and we live in a world that's changing very rapidly. Every few months you got a lot of change happening in terms of technology, the way we communicate, and even how politics happens in many countries. So what we need to do is harness the resources that's in our hands, and we believe that a lot of the resources are in the hands of businesses, and that's why part of what Greenpeace does is try to transform the business practices so that it becomes more sustainable.
Is Greenpeace opposed to capitalism?
No, we have not categorically stated that as an institutional position. You can imagine there are people, activists within Greenpeace, who probably have a difficulty accepting the world economic order. But change does not happen like that. I mean, that's an illusion if you can assume that change happens overnight. What we should focus on is really trying to transform the world as it is right now without being trapped in that illusion.
And in your conversation with the corporate sector, how do you adapt them to the kind of lingo that would make the world a better place to be in?
Well, I'll give you an example. Just yesterday, people may have read in the news that we did an action in Barcelona, and this is also part of a global project that we have targeting Samsung, for example, with one of their models having a problem. They recalled, if you remember, recalled one of their cell phone models because of a problem with the battery. Now we have an issue of how they recall of this and how they dispose of this. And what we're trying to say is, instead of disposing of all of this, why don't you recycle all of these units into something that you can use, that you can bring back into the market? So it's a simple narrative that we want to tell companies. There's something you can do, and that's actually good for your financial bottom line. That's the language that companies understand, and we want to engage them in a conversation. If it's good for their financial bottom line, there's also a lot of evidence that it's also good for the environment.
Today we're speaking to Nadarev Yeb Sanyo, Executive Director of the Greenpeace in Southeast Asia, and we're talking about how to balance economic growth with environmental problems. Coming up next, Food Politics, BFM 89.9. Today we are speaking with Nadarev Yeb Sanyo, Executive Director of Greenpeace Southeast Asia, and we're talking about environmental problems coupled with economic growth. Yeb, Greenpeace's stance on against GMO actually is quite well known. What do you think is the science behind this? Because surveys show that an overwhelming majority of scientists have nothing against GMO foods, and they find them generally safe to eat.
That's a very good area of debate, and the conversation there is very interesting. Yes, indeed, Greenpeace historically has been very strong against genetically modified engineering, and especially when we talk about food. Our main basis for that position is the precautionary principle, and that principle says, in the absence of clear, concrete scientific evidence, you are on the side of caution. And we're talking about safety here for people, and we eat food.
But these are research that go into the Journal of Animal Sciences, for example, and a lot of very well-respected medical journals actually say that GMOs have been around for the last decade or two. Looking at the trillions of meals that have been served to people the world over, it appears that empirically there is no, and scientifically as well, that there is no harm with GMO foods.
Indeed, there's been a lot of studies out there looking at the harm caused by GMO foods and also how it is impacting on the environment. But aside from the environmental impact that we look at when we talk about GMOs, we look at the broader political, socio-political aspect of it. And that's why we've shifted our language, our messaging into in promoting more ecologically sustainable agriculture rather than just be focusing on one particular kind of technological means to producing food. What we see across the world is a lot of poverty and hunger not benefiting many people. And the problem is the control of food. And that's what we're very concerned about, how industrial agriculture is only benefiting very few.
So you rail against these big corporate food producers and grain producers. For example, again, from your website, 6 corporations control 75% of the world pesticides market. Factory farms account for a big chunk of food production, and 3/4 of the global grain trade controlled by only 4 companies. companies. But if you want to go and highlight the plight of the small farmers, for instance, can these farmers compete effectively with big corporates, given that they don't have the advantage of economies of scale?
What we have started to realize is that in more recent years, small farmers play a very big role in ensuring that we have food on our tables. And what we're talking about is food safety, food security, and long-term availability and affordability of food. And small farmers right now in the big picture context play that very important, crucial role. Why? Because there's the fundamental debate here, Julian, is really whether we have enough resources that we can use. And those are two philosophical sides. And one side says, no, there's enough resources on Earth. There's enough soil that we can plant on that can be used continuously. But on the other side of the debate, we offer a view where, no, the soil is being poisoned, our land, air, and water resources are being polluted, and there will come a time we reach the tipping point and there will be a crisis. And so that's also our thinking around our position on agriculture, because if we go on and polluting the soil, it will stop being productive, and at some point it will be a big problem for all of us. And that's what small farmers put on the table as far as this conversation is concerned. They can farm sustainably, and now that we're talking about a big problem like climate change, we have to focus on supporting local farmers and the food miles of the food we eat. We have to reduce.
I think that's a very noble objective to have, but if you take away the big corporates and focus on environmentally sensitive produced food, will there be enough food to go around to feed everybody?
We believe that there is enough for small farmers if we give them support and if we foster a more sustainable mindset in terms of society's livable cities and make that connection between rural and urban. It can be
because these corporations invest in a lot of technology and innovation, and they make the yields of farming and production a lot higher to not only focus on the existing population but for future populations as well.
No, that's true. It's yield is a very important discussion in the context of food, but for us it's really important that yield is not sacrificed at the altar of long-term sustainability. And we know for a fact that yields are only increased because we do have a price to pay, and that's the environment where we're using pesticides, we're using chemicals. That really means we're going to be able to use the soil for a shorter period.
Okay, so that's the question, right? Who pays for it? Because obviously Greenpeace advocates buying as much organic food products are concerned, or buying products that use a lot less pesticides and chemicals. But, you know, I go to my local organic food shop and the prices of food there is so expensive.
No, that's true, and that's an issue that we need to address. Food does not have to be expensive, even if it's safe and organic. And that means a much bigger effort across societies to foster that mindset, so that the prices of commodities, especially food, even if it's safe and organic, that it can be affordable. I mean, there are lots of people who can produce food that's safe for everyone without it having to be pegged at the rate of luxury consumer goods. So.
Now, palm oil is something that's so controversial here, and the Western world rails against the clearing of land for the agriculture and farming, the planting of palm oil trees. What is your view on palm oil plantations?
Well, Greenpeace has a very strong view on unsustainable palm oil production. And I have to clarify, Greenpeace is not against palm oil per se. But if palm oil companies destroy the forest at the expense of local communities and at the expense of the ecosystem services that forests provide, and also if it's only for the gain and profit of the company, that's something we stand up against. And We see a lot of illegal palm oil operations as well in the region. There's a lot of problems around the practices where peatlands are drained so that they are converted into oil palm plantations. If it goes out of hand, then we have a big problem around that. We want palm oil to be sustainable because it is a raw material that's used in very diverse ways.
Today we're speaking to Nadarev Yep Sanyo, Executive Director of Greenpeace Southeast Asia. Now, Yep, let's talk about your funding. You try to achieve a degree of independence, and from your website again, I quote, you want to ensure financial independence and you don't accept money from either companies or governments. How successful has this objective or this self-imposed restriction been in raising money for Greenpeace to do its work?
Well, Greenpeace has been in existence for more than 40 years using this model of getting support from many individuals around the world, and it continues to be the main avenue for our funding. And for us, it maintains our independence. We are able to say what we want to say. We realize that there are lots of people around the world who care about our work, and we're thankful for that. There's at least 5 million individuals around the world who continue to support us directly.
Okay, and I had the pleasure of meeting your deputy fundraising director as well. And the fact that such a position has been created shows that money is such an important part of your operations. But at the same time, can you reveal some of those numbers? I mean, how much do you need to do your operations and how much funding you receive, how much assets Greenpeace has at the moment? Because without that kind of transparency, then it puts Greenpeace at a level below the corporations, which are where their accounts are needed to be audited.
No, we were very transparent with our finances, and we put that out in our annual reports, not just in Southeast Asia, but globally as well. It varies wildly in terms of the funds that we have in different offices, but we also operate very responsibly with a lean team.
So what's the number here?
Can.
What are the total collection of Greenpeace a year?
So I can speak for Southeast Asia. For Southeast Asia, we have enough supporters that can generate. So I'm thinking in different currencies. So I'm trying to convert
that
right now. But it can be in the neighborhood of about, I'd say, $4 million roughly from the total from the individuals.
That doesn't sound big.
It's not that big because we do have a very lean operations and we do need to operate responsibly and make the most out of the funds that we get.
There are certain accusations that Greenpeace is actually a very rich organization and hiding behind the veil of an NGO. But actually a full-fledged commercial operations with fancy marketing campaigns. And also the fact that, you know, some of these accusations that have been leveled to you impinges onto your very idea of independence.
These accusations are, some of them might be based on certain experiences and things that have happened as part of the Greenpeace being a human organization, and we don't claim to be perfect. Sometimes we make mistakes. Sometimes we have oversights. But essentially, we try as much as possible, do our best to be responsible with our finances, and also to be transparent. And when we talk about financial independence, We make it a point. That's why we're very serious with raising funds from individuals who care about the work that we do, so that we maintain that independence.
Now we have 30 seconds left. Should the environment take precedence over human development?
I wouldn't say that I would answer that categorically, because we believe, especially from the perspective of Southeast Asians, both should go hand in hand. We can never dissociate environmental protection from development.
Thank you so much for your time. And that was Nadarev Yeb Sanyo, Executive Director for Greenpeace Southeast Asia. And today we were talking about the balancing of environmental concerns with economic development. I'm Julian Ng for BFM 89.9.
That episode of BFM Breakfast Grill was brought to you by U-Mobile, where data hearts you.